All right, I think we should go ahead and get started. Again, good afternoon. Thanks for coming to the second briefing. This is going to examine the impacts of the tax reform proposal on the Northeast Midwest region. As I mentioned earlier, my name is Charlie Bartsch, and I'm currently serving as visiting senior fellow at the Northeast Midwest Institute. My focus there is on urban revitalization and economic development issues. As I mentioned at the outset, I want to thank Congressman Brian Higgins from New York and other members of the Northeast Midwest Coalition for their interest in promoting regional revitalization and for their help in facilitating this briefing. This part of the briefing is going to focus on historic rehabilitation tax credits. H.R. 1 calls for repealing them. This would eliminate a tool which has been used extensively in the revitalization of older cities and towns, often for smaller scale economic development projects. We heard about new markets just, previously. A lot of their focus is on larger projects. Historic credits have often been used very successfully for smaller scale projects. And in fact, historic rehab credits were one of the first issues that the bipartisan Northeast Midwest Congressional Coalition took on in 1978, shortly after its founding, to use the tax code to encourage market-based private investment in older neighborhood areas, to attract private capital to areas where decades of blight served as a real barrier to revitalization. Nationally, the impacts of these credits have been substantial. According to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, in fiscal year 2016, 1,299 projects claimed about $1.43 billion in historic tax credits. But you have to look at what they've accomplished. They've leveraged over $7 billion in private investment, much for smaller manufacturing and commercial projects, less than $1 million in size. And we know that these are the size of projects that often have the most difficulty in attracting private capital. They've generated over $9.9 billion in state and local tax revenues and created over 108,000 jobs. You know, in so many towns across the Northeast Midwest region, tax credit projects have been the catalyst for neighborhood and Main Street revitalization. I'm pleased to introduce the experts on this panel who will take a look at these issues in more detail. First up is John Leith Tetreault. He's chairman of the Historic Tax Credit Coalition. He's going to explain how historic tax credits attract private capital for small business and help revitalize distressed areas. And he's going to discuss what their loss could mean. And he'll be followed by Patrick Robertson, who's managing director of FTI Consulting. Patrick is going to provide the factual and analytical context for the credits and discuss some of their economic impacts on communities. I have a bio sheet, there's a bio sheet out there that has full bios on there. So at this point, I'm going to just turn it over to John, who's going to get us started. Thank you.
Thanks, Charlie, and thank you to the Northeast Midwest Institute for sponsoring this briefing. Charlie mentioned, I chair the Historic Tax Credit Coalition, which has been representing the historic tax credit industry since 2009, and our purpose is to work with Congress to educate them on the value of the historic tax credit. We've worked with the IRS on various revenue procedures over the last few years to iron out some issues related to what it takes to be considered a real partner in these transactions, and we also do a lot of research on the impact of the credit, including publishing an annual report on the economic impact of the historic tax credit. So it's certainly a nail-biting time. I know our lobbyist, Patrick, has got one eye on his talk and the other eye on his iPhone to see what's happening in Ways and Means as we speak. I'm going to provide a little background on the credit, and I'm going to offer some case studies in several of the states that are partners in this institute. Then turn over to Patrick to talk about legislation and what we're seeing and what we're hoping, I guess, to happen. The historic tax credit really, I'll go all the way back to 1976, as part of some bicentennial legislation during the Ford administration. Congress provided an accelerated depreciation feature, 15-year depreciation, which was roughly double the normal depreciation period for certified historic property rehabilitation. In 78, that became a 10% credit, along with the accelerated depreciation. But the credit, as we know it today, was really put in place by the Reagan administration and Congress in 1981 as part of their stimulus package and tax cut package. So there was a tiered credit of 25% for historic buildings, and then for older buildings there was a 20% credit and 15% credit. In 86, we came up for review as part of the 86 Tax Reform Act, and we were retained in the code and made permanent, but it collapsed those three tiers to two, so we had a 20% credit for historic properties and 10% for buildings built before 1936. So these credits are usually utilized by major corporations. Developers, under the current code anyway, generally don't have to pay taxes because they have so many deductions from all their real estate holdings, and so they essentially market these credits to corporations who are in a tax position to use them. So, you know, typical investors, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, Nationwide Insurance, East West Bank, Citibank, etc., they will purchase ownership interest in a partnership, and typically they purchase a 99% interest in what we call limited liability corporations, and that gives them the right to use the credits for their own account. And so there's a market for this, so one investor may offer 93 cents on the dollar for the credit, someone else offers 94 cents, and the developer, using syndicators or just their own staff, will choose among those offers and close the transaction with that partner, who has to stay in place for 5 years. So there's a 5-year recapture period if the building is altered in some way that violates the Secretary of the Interior's standards for historic properties. There's a recapture. That's pretty rare. But more typically, if there's a recapture, it would be because the property fails, there's a bankruptcy, and ownership changes. However, we've done a study that shows that recapture is rather limited. It's 0.77% over a 10-year measuring period that included the Great Recession. So it's a 99% success rate, which is far better than real estate in general. And the purpose of the credit is to fill the financing gap between what a bank will lend and what the project costs. And I have a banking background. Before going to the National Trust, we would get these projects in, and we would typically loan 65 to 70% of the cost, and it's that low because the appraisals would come in low. These are inner city properties, unproven neighborhoods, and so the appraisals would come in relatively low, but the costs would always come in pretty high. So we would base our loan on a percentage of the value of the building, and that typically came out at 65 or 70%. So what does a developer do? They've got 30% gap to cover. So to get a decent return on investment, money out of their pocket, maybe they put in 10%. You still have a 20% gap. Now, I know that math kind of works out exactly, and it's not quite that simple. But the point is that the credit covers the gap between what a bank will lend, what a developer is willing to put in out of their own pocket, and the total cost of the building. And it is a gap that has persisted. When you look at legislative history going all the way back, that gap has persisted for some 40 years since the credit was initially. And it's because rehab costs a little bit more, and the banks will lend less, and that's stayed as sort of a part of the equation for 40 or more years. So it's just as much needed today, the rationale that was presented by Reagan administration in 81 and seen again and reviewed in 86 in the 86 Tax Act. The economics are pretty much the same. So, you know, the coalition has had a relationship with the Rutgers Center for Urban Policy Research since going back to the early 2000s, and they have developed for us the Preservation Economic Impact Model, which looks at the overall economic impacts of the credit on the U.S. economy, and then state by state, and using statistics from the National Park Service going back to 1978. So you see these three, four numbers up here. The Park Service tells us that over 42,000 buildings have been renovated, about 2.5 million jobs created, and those are, you know, jobs in the buildings, those are jobs in, you know, what they call indirect and induced parts of the economy. So it's, you work at a lumber yard and the demand for lumber goes up, they hire a couple more people, those people go out and shop and buy more groceries, so there's a ripple effect in the economy. The $1.20 on the bottom indicates that for every federal dollar spent on this program, there's been $28.2 billion since 1978, $1.20 comes back to the U.S. Treasury. So $29.8 billion in revenue versus $25.2 billion in credits allocated. So we make the point to Congress that this is revenue positive. It helps lower the rates in a very small way, but it's certainly not a negative in terms of revenue production that's needed to do tax reform. So we feel like not only is it a small number, but it's also not a drag on the objectives of tax reform. The $130 billion is the total development cost of all those transactions, so it's about a 4-to-5-to-1 leverage of the federal dollars that are spent. And lastly, this is a catalytic credit. I don't know how many of you have seen one of these projects occur in your hometown, whether it's rural or urban. The first project tends to generate a higher level of neighborhood confidence on the part of developers. It raises appraised values, so now banks will loan more on the next building. And, you know, these buildings are typically in 19th century walkable neighborhoods, and so the buildings are close together. So they tend to, that first building tends to generate more spin-off development around it. And we've actually done a study that looks at 6 different cities and shows that business license requests go up, building permits go up, and the community's tax base increases. So it's sort of, you could look at it anecdotally and look around your hometown and say, gosh, we have a whole district here now. Well, you started with one building. That's very typical. And a part of our story is to say, you know, you're getting a good deal here for a small amount of money.
What if those 6 cities might be in the Northeast Midwest region?
They might be.
The one you just mentioned. Yeah, the 6 city studies.
The case study. So what do you think? So we got Georgia, we got Utah, we got Ohio.
Baltimore on there?
I'd be happy to provide you copies of that study. So this is sort of a summary of what I've just said, I think this is again showing it's revenue positive, and it's a better jobs generator than many other more typically thought of stimulus activities. So highway construction produces less jobs than historic rehab. And it's clearly, when you look at the jobs to materials ratio in a rehab job, it's 60% labor, 40% materials. On new construction, it's the opposite. It's 40% jobs, 60% materials. So it's a very efficient generator of jobs. And I think what these stats show, you know, downtowns are booming right now. If you travel around the country as I have, you see every major city that you go to has a group of downtown transactions that are really taking advantage of this baby boomer, empty nester move back to the city, plus the interest of millennials in living and working in cool space, in, you know, historic properties, and where they can walk to work or take the bike, you know, travel by bike to work. So it's these are the buildings that the credit finances are the buildings that the market wants. And we've been asked, well, wouldn't, you know, the market's so strong, why do you need the credits? It's because the numbers don't work no matter how much the demand is. In the House bill, we are, credit is currently eliminated at the end of 2017. So there's a very severe transition rules. And the exception is if you own a building at by the end of this year, 12/31/17, you have another 6 months or so to sort of get started with construction, and there's no end point. There's no placed in service deadline. So that's, you know, that means if you haven't already bought the building, but you could have a pipeline of projects. You might be in a due diligence period on a building where you're thinking about buying it. Well, you haven't bought it by the end of the year, you can't use credits in 2018. So what I want to do is run through some case studies of projects within your state, and then look at the overview of how much that particular state has utilized the credit, and take a look at some of the characteristics. So the first is the Equitable Building in Des Moines, Iowa. Is that one of your states?
It is.
It is, okay.
Is it?
So this is the old Equitable of Iowa Insurance Company. It's 19 stories right downtown in Des Moines. 146 market rate apartments, 26,000 square feet of office space and retail on the first two floors. Total development cost, $42 million. And the historic tax credit equity that came in, contributed by an investor, is $6.9 million. If the developer would put in that amount of cash, they would probably have no return on investment. And the likelihood is they sold the property, they never get their money back. So the credit is critical. And the developer is the Fouch Brothers, like you're based in Kansas City, Missouri. So looking at Iowa, it's a little bit too small to see, but you see the totals here, 257 projects between 2002 2016, $1.1 billion in total development costs across the state. A nice mix of these dots. If it's a single dot, it's a small town, typically with one transaction, and then when you see the larger dots with a number, that's multiple projects in a larger town. So a nice mix of rural and urban in Iowa, and over 10,000 jobs created. And it's a highly important credit, particularly in small towns. I mean, how many other opportunities does Fairmount, West Virginia have to attract federal dollars on a project where the numbers don't work? So it's same question, same equation in Iowa. So the Owosso, and by the way, these are all projects closed by the New Markets Tax Credit. National Trust Community Investment Corporation, which I still work for as a public policy advisor. This one was recently closed. It's a small armory in Owosso, Michigan. Former National Guard armory built in 1915. It's going to be office space for the Chamber of Commerce and a number of organizations that promote small business development, the community space, as well as a farmer's market. So this is, the developer was the Chamber. $5.68 million total cost and $827,000 in credit equity. Now, this was where we used MTCIC's small deal fund for New Markets. So you can combine historic and New Markets credits if it's in a low-income census tract and it's also a certified historic building. So this is a case where we did combine the credits. So Michigan actually ranks 10th among all states in the amount of qualified rehab expenditures, or those are the costs of a project that qualify for the credits, in 2016. And I should mention, by the way, that 34 states have complementary state historic tax credits, and a lot of these projects, the ones I've mentioned and will mention, have used both the federal and the state credits. So almost 30,000 jobs generated in Michigan over the past 15 years, 315 projects, $2.2 billion in total development costs. As you can see, quite a bit, 91 projects in Detroit, 13 in Kalamazoo, 96 in Grand Rapids. So the large and medium towns are getting a lot, and then you see the smaller dots, those are all typically the single projects in rural areas. Detroit has been particularly helped by the historic tax credit. Bedrock Development, Dan Gilbert's company, has done a lot of renovation of old office buildings in downtown Detroit and brought tens of thousands of jobs back to the city. So the Williamsburg Savings Bank in Brooklyn, New York. This project's located right over the Brooklyn Bridge on the Brooklyn side in the Williamsburg section. This was circa 1875 savings bank. It just has the most gorgeous interior. If you ever go there, just figure out a way to get into the building and just look at it. I mean, it's just marble floors, marble columns. It's just, you can't imagine why they would build to this level and this ornateness for a savings bank in 1875, but I think times were different, materials were at lower cost. So total development cost $23 million, $3.5 million federal credits, and here the state credit of New York, which is a good one, provided $2 million. It's now turned into an event space. I think Meryl Streep's daughter was married there about a year ago. So it's on the radar of anybody who's anybody in New York City. And the developer bought land next door and is building a hotel, and so this space will become the premier event space for the hotel. New York does quite well compared to other states. Ranks 8th in total projects in 2016 and 3rd in qualified rehab expenditure. So it is, as you can see, lots of activity in the Hudson Valley, and particularly in the upper tier in Rochester, Buffalo, Syracuse. So that's where the the property values are low, the rents you can get for renovated properties are low, and so the need for the credit is absolutely critical. 491 projects last 15 years, $4 billion in total development costs, 28,000 jobs. So it's and less use in New York City because the rents you can get are so ridiculous. You can do projects in New York City without historic. You can do a historic building, may or may not use the credits depending on what you pay for the building. So it's more of a sort of Rust Belt city phenomenon in New York. Jobs Cafe in Cincinnati, Ohio. This is a recently closed MTCIC project. This is 8 buildings built between 1865 and 1880. We're all within 3 blocks of each other. It's in the over the Rhine neighborhood, and it's a sort of a poster child project for both the historic and new markets credits, a combined project. 91,000 square feet of office, retail, and restaurant. It's a small business incubator. It's 68 housing units, of which 56 are affordable. The model group is the developer. Total development cost $27 million, $4 million contributed by new markets and 3.7 by the federal credit. So you hear a lot about gentrification and over the Rhine. This is a project that's sort of anti-gentrification. It provides affordable housing and business development, skills building for entrepreneurs that are just starting out. Ohio is really there's the powerhouse in the use of credits all over the state. 982 transactions, $3 billion in total development costs, $448 million in credits that are earned by those projects, over 23,000 jobs. So Ohio ranks 3rd in the number of projects and 7th in qualified rehab expenditures in 2016. This is a place like Cleveland. I mean, the rent you can get for office and housing are just extremely low, and you cannot renovate and start property in Cleveland without some kind of subsidy. And historic credit is really, by local officials and nonprofits, indicate to me that the city has been transformed by the historic tax credit, because they're just what's the number in Cleveland? 178 transactions in Cleveland, all in a concentrated downtown. It's all fed on each other, and it is a true revitalization story that the historic credit has a lot to do with. Energy Innovation Center, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This was the old Connolly Trade School, built in 1933, 160,000 square feet, and it was turned into a classroom space, shops, labs, offices, and organizations providing workforce development in the green energy industry. So they're training young people to do energy efficiency audits and retrofits. They're training people to get involved in alternative energy projects. There's also a research component, because several Pittsburgh universities also have labs and offices there. So this is a terrific project, great outcome. The developer was the Pittsburgh Gateways Corporation. They're a nonprofit. Pennsylvania, another superstar in the use of the historic tax credit, 613 projects, $3.8 billion in total development costs, 58,000 jobs in the last 15 years. And you can see big concentrations in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, Harrisburg, some of the largest and mid-sized towns and quite a bit in the rural areas of the state. It's a historic state. We know how to use the credits to benefit their economy. Lastly, the Fortress Building in Milwaukee, and it certainly looks like a fortress. This was the former F. Meyer Boot and Shoe Company that's being converted by the Alexander Company out of Madison, Wisconsin, into 130 market-rate units with some first-floor retail, 28,000 square feet. It's in the Brewers Hill Historic District, so it's near the Schlitz Stadium and other downtown uses. It's a very walkable neighborhood. It's in the Brewers Hill Historic District, it is just closing now and should be in service in the next year or so. So in Wisconsin, again, a good high-quality developer community. Milwaukee, 66 transactions, is the highest, but you can see quite a spread, evenly spread around the state. With that, we can stop for questions here, or we can put it back to Jeremy.
Does anybody have any just clarifying questions before we turn to Patrick? I just have to say that I think one of the things that you mentioned that really resonated with me was this whole idea of how this connects, and it really is mutually enforcing with other tools. I mean, yeah. A lot of my background with Northeast Midwest way back was in sort of the brownfields issue arena, mm-hmm. Rehabbing. I mean, all those pictures you showed of those formers, I mean, yeah. You know that there were probably minor, environmental brownfield issues in them. Yeah. And the rehab tax credit has been such a vital component of the financing package for so many brownfield projects.
Absolutely.
Especially in the smaller communities where they just don't have any capacity at all to really pull things together. I mean, the rehab credit is just...
I don't know what the percentage is, but it's quite high because a lot of these buildings have PCBs, they have red paint, a lot of environmental issues, and they're within a brownfields district. So that... A credit, as we mentioned, can be combined with the New Markets credit, but also if it's affordable housing, it can be combined with the low-income housing tax credit. So it was designed, since it's such a thin subsidy, it works perfectly, and it was designed to fit in with other credits with more specific purposes.
Okay. So I'm just going to sit here and first of all thank all of you who are already enough to still be here. We definitely appreciate that. I also... want to make just one clarifying point, the maps that John showed, we've got maps for all 18 states in the Northeast Midwest region outside. They're also available on our website, historiccredit.com. If you are looking to do some research, you can go there and get economic data and maps for any state if you have friends who are asking the same idea. There's also, I think I'll start this by going back to the beginning of the credit, as John did, when President Reagan put the credit into place in 1981 and then was fighting for it again in 84 and 1986, he said not only is this good for preserving our history, but it makes economic good sense. And I think John's laid out the economic good sense argument, and what I think is unique about the historic tax credit is we've got 34 years of data on the economic good sense that it makes. We've shown what it can do in communities. So not only do we have it empirically, we can look out our windows and see it, and we can look out our windows and see why it's still needed. I think if you think about your community, you think about the six projects that John laid out, the Fortress Building or the Energy Center in Pittsburgh, but you can also think of a dozen examples of empty buildings, former textile mills. So I'm from the Ohio River Valley. I grew up in steel country, and there we have empty steel company headquarters that are sitting empty, rotting away, and the historic tax credit can bring those back to economic use. Wheeling, West Virginia is right on the Ohio River. It's exactly that kind of town. I think it just sneaks out of the Northeast Midwest region by about a mile and a half. They had a steel company that closed, just like the industry in Buffalo and Cleveland and elsewhere closed, but they have the infrastructure. Right? As we talk about the need for enhanced infrastructure in the country, you have a historic building which has sewer and water and electricity to it and all those things, and roads and sidewalks, and they have things you don't need to build, you just need to rehab the inside of the building. And So the developer sits down and says, all right, I think this community will support this many office units and this many market rate housing units and this many affordable housing units, and this is what I can think I can charge. And then they sit down and they say, all right, here's what it's going to cost me to buy the building, and then here's what it's going to cost me to rehab it. And John makes the case that those numbers don't work out. What you see as income is not going to match what it takes to rehab the building. So one of the arguments that's made about the tax reform bill is everyone will have a lower tax rate, they will have more money in their pockets, and they will not need incentives to make economic decisions, right? So if I'm a developer and I make $100,000 at, let's say I pay a full 35% tax rate, I keep $65,000 in my pocket, right, today. If I have a 20% tax rate, excuse me, or 25% tax rate, or 30% tax rate, or whatever I have, I keep a little bit more money in my pocket. Let's say now I have $75,000 in my pocket. So last year I had 65, this year I have 75. I'm not going to make an uneconomical decision just because I have a little more money in my pocket, right? I'm not going to take on a project that I think is going to lose money just because I keep some more of my taxes as a pass-through. I'm going to still make decisions based on what will get me a return. So I'm looking at, should I take in Dubuque, Iowa, should I take an old grain mill and turn it into market rate housing? Or should I build a Taco Bell at the interstate? New construction, really easy, throw up four walls and have something that generates cash right away? Or do I go and take a risk on a building that once I get into it, maybe there's something wrong with it, maybe it becomes more expensive than I appreciated. So the one thing we want to rebut in this tax reform argument, that is, if the rate is lower, this will still happen. At the end of the day, it's Congress's prerogative to make policy decisions about what we incentivize or not in the tax code. And that's exactly the role of why members have been elected to Congress. But making a decision thinking something will happen that won't, we want to make sure that everybody understands that just because people have lower tax rates doesn't mean they'll do things that are uneconomical. The other thing I want to just sort of touch on is the question of, so we talk about, I think 38,000 buildings have been done. Maybe it's 42,000. I think I've been doing this too long. I always forget what the number is. That's a lot of buildings, right? And I'm not going to sit up here and hide from you and say that's not a significant inventory. But I challenge all of you to not find an underutilized building, a building that's empty, vacant, falling down, that couldn't be revitalized and make your community better. They're in every community across the country, right? My hometown, as I said, is on the Ohio River, just outside of Pittsburgh. Certainly, we saw a great example from Pittsburgh, and there's a lot going on there. But there's also a lot of buildings that are underutilized. And when I think about this Amazon HQ2 issue, right? Amazon's out and says, everybody give us bids about what it would be like to host Amazon's second headquarters. There are choices there, right? If you think about the Quicken loans, the Dan Gilbert campus in downtown Detroit. So what Quicken did was it bought up half of downtown Detroit, rehabbed it, and made it into an urban campus and revitalized downtown Detroit in a pretty efficient use of resources. And what Apple did is Apple built a brand new fancy spaceship-looking thing in the middle of a greenfield in Silicon Valley. And those are two ways to give your workers really cool headquarters, right? Both are cool. Neither are wrong. Both are certainly attracting top talent and doing really well. But without the historic tax credit, that Quicken example doesn't happen. There's no way you're going to take 3 or 4 or 6 or 8 square city blocks, rehab them, and put people, you know, we were in Detroit for a conference that took a tour of the Quicken facility, and, you know, you're not going to have, everybody has a giant fat head at their desk, because they all have open cubicles, so there's, you know, one of those, like, on ESPN basketball game heads right behind your desk so people can find you when they're looking for you, and they've taken these really old Detroit landmarks and turned them into hip, cool workspaces. Maybe that was only on the floor they took us to, but I don't think that's true. And then to John's point about catalytic effect. So think about a blighted neighborhood in Baltimore. You take and you do the first project, and the federal government invests in that first project. The developer takes a risk, and you get a couple of anchor tenants. Well, once those people start coming, You need coffee shops. And once those people start going to coffee shops, they need a place to go to lunch. And then all of a sudden you need a convenience store. And some of those end up being historic rehabs, and some of them just end up being things that happen because the demand has been brought to the neighborhood. The New Markets folks talked about the Atlas Theater. I think that that's an example of a twinned New Markets historic project over on H Street. H Street was not there before the Atlas Theater was done. The Atlas Theater development with New Markets and historic, and then the city's sort of commitment to widen the sidewalks and redo the streets and start to put the, for a long time, ill-fated streetcar in, was the signal to all those bars and restaurants that it was okay. It's okay to put your private capital up and to come redevelop this area because we're investing in it too. We're making sure that this block, this 12 blocks, are going to succeed. The other thing I want to talk about is that historic is a market-based credit, right? So this is not a slight to New Markets or low income. It's a difference. New Markets and low income are administered through different programs within the federal government, and they are capped. Historic has been sort of capped by its own demand for years. I think the statistic you cited was $1.4 billion last year. That's the highest credit we've had in years. It was about $800 million in 07, but it sort of vacillates between $750 million and $1.2 billion, depending on the year. And it's been in that band for most of two decades, right? It doesn't really move much. There's not that much inventory. It's not a credit that many people are good at using. And it's something that you really have to do right. And so historic allows the market to decide what projects get done and how they're funded and whether they need to be twinned and all those things. And it's really just sort of an open process to get there. The other thing about the historic tax credit is it ensures that our history is preserved in the right way. So the National Park Service administers the historic tax credit. And they have rules called the Secretary of Standards that tell you how to do it. And what happens is, if you're going to get federal money invested in your building, you're going to preserve its history, right? You're going to do it the right way. You're not going to tear everything down but the front wall and build a modern building behind it. You're going to keep the original windows or something like the original windows. You're going to make sure that you don't build a 15-story addition on the top that you can see from the street. You're going to keep the elevator lobby. You're going to keep the hallways the same. You're going to make it look like what it was. And I think when you think about that kind of rehab, it's exactly what you're seeing in the Cannon Building, right? If they rehabbed the Cannon Building and made it look like the Hart Senate Office Building, everyone would go crazy. It's not what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to make it look like what it always looks like. And that's what the historic tax credit does. And then the last thing, before we open to questions, I just want to take a step back and talk mechanically about how the credit works, which is probably where we should have started. But we didn't. But just generally, what's historic? How do you get the credit? How does it work, right? So there's two ways to be historic. You can be on the National Register for Historic Places, eligible for the National Register for Historic Places, or in a National Register Historic District and be a contributing structure. So there's a Register of Historic Places in the country. They're pretty broad in terms of what history is. It doesn't have to be Revolutionary War era history. It doesn't have to be the 1875 building we looked at. The Astrodome in Houston is a historic building because it represents an era and an architecture that should be saved. Buildings from the 60s and 70s are still historic and can apply for the credit. So you get listed one of those three ways, and then you submit to the Park Service a plan for rehabilitating the building. And in most cases, the Park Service will negotiate with you under those standards about what you can and can't do. And they'll say, gosh, these windows are, you know, original and they need to stay, or this, you can alter this or whatever. And then you get to a plan, and then you do your work and you submit another application to the Park Service and you say, look, this is what I told you I was going to do. This is what I did. And the Park Service says you did. And you staple that certification to your tax return and take your 20% credit against qualified rehab expenses. Why are qualified rehab expenses important? You don't get a credit for buying the building. You don't get a credit for building a parking lot. You just get a credit for 20% of what you did in rehabilitation. And that's where these partnerships come in. But not every project what's the 70% of the projects are under $2.5 million in QREs. I mean, a ton of projects are small deals where the developer is either taking the tax, the developer owner, is taking the tax credit over a number of years. The mega projects have those banks as developers that John talked about. Main Street in, Dubuque or somewhere in York, Pennsylvania, or wherever you are, Kenyon, Ohio, right? All those places are going to be really owners taking the credit, and that's the vast majority of the number of projects that get done. So that's it for my list, Charlie. Happy to do questions.
Questions, yes.
Yeah, I had a quick question. In terms of the deficit, I know the Joint Committee on Taxation released their scores, and it said that the deficit would decrease by $9.3 billion in a decade.
Right.
I'm sure that it's pushed together the other rehabilitation methods, but how does the HTC fit in there?
Right, so the static score of repealing the historic tax credit is a lot, is a positive to the Treasury of $9.3 billion. But what you heard John say is that for every dollar expended, you get $1.20 back in federal tax revenue. This is sort of a regional versus national issue, right? That $1.20 is going to be spent somewhere in economic activity. The historic tax credit helps it be spent on rehabbing historic buildings in areas, wherever that is. So if you look at a building in, so let's say a developer has that $1.20 to spend anywhere. If it's new construction in Silicon Valley, that's where it'll go. If it's historic rehab in Cleveland, that's where it'll go. So from the Joint Committee's perspective, that money could be spent anywhere. From local communities' perspective, the historic tax credit helps put it in old communities, communities with history that then generate the economic activity. So,
other questions? this is sort of, you sort of addressed this, but I suppose it should be asked. I mean, so is there any, you know, recognizing what this does and how it helps fill capital gaps and all of these benefits, is there something in the tax bill that could, in theory, sort of, you know, sort of address what would be lost?
To make up for it.
Right.
No. You know, the authors of the tax bill will argue that lower rates will smooth all economic activity. When Chairman Camp thought about repealing the charitable deduction, that was one of the arguments was made. People will have more money and they will give to charities. Charities didn't agree with that. This bill doesn't repeal the charitable deduction, so we don't have a way to test that theory. But I think that, you know, I sort of made the argument that anyone with more money in their pocket still doesn't make economically unsound decisions. And that's what we sort of continue to argue. And this is something that John talked about, that capital gap, and he did as a banker. You just don't lend 100% of rehab costs.
Other questions?
Anyone
have a question?
I have one more thing I wanted to mention. Sort of the flip side of this argument on catalytic impact. So we talked about how one building builds confidence in a neighborhood. Investors come in after that first building and renovate around it. If you look at the opposite, without this credit, that building that's been sitting there for 30 years, the old factory on Main Street, will either continue to sit or it'll be torn down. And you'll have a big vacant lot on Main Street, and we all know that cities are better at tearing buildings down than figuring out what to do with this. So you're going to have one Main Street manager in Iowa said, we have a bunch of pocket parks all down Main Street in Woodbine, Illinois, in Iowa. So there's a, you know, the opposite. And then when the appraiser looks at that project that wants to go online next door, they're going to say, well, all right, the value could be $100,000, but with that thing sitting next to it, the value is really $50,000. Mm-hmm. So they can't get the loan they need, and it has a negative spin as well without the credit.
I think just from a pure, you know, community and economic development impact and just really a quality of life impact, I mean, the credits can be very valuable in the older cities in our region. I think one of the things I mentioned earlier, that even some of the potential linkage to some of the environmental issues, and it even goes beyond that. I mean, the extent to which you can redeploy older buildings
you know, using this credit, using other resources, well, you can have really positive impacts on everything from like watershed protection to, you know, all sorts of things, because you're not putting that Taco Bell out of the green field at the interchange, but in fact you're maybe generating a family-owned restaurant in town in one of these older buildings.
I've decided maybe my Apple example is better than Taco Bell now that I've used
yeah,
it, but
maybe.
That's okay.
Well, except that I think probably Taco Bell is a more replicable sort of point of reference for a lot of people than an Apple headquarters. I want to thank you all. I mean, we lose this room in a few minutes, so I want to thank you for coming. I want to look at this information out. Again, if anybody does have any follow-up questions, just let us know. We'll get you some answers. I mean, this is an important issue that I'm sure a lot of your offices are considering. So anything we can do to help you make a decision, just let us know. So, thank you.
Thank you.